once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure. Together, we are bald. Well, that wasn't as exciting as I expected it to be. We're bearded. No. Mm-hmm. We are eco-babble, spouting, bald, bearded people, and that is our first disclosure.
Yes.
Yes, we give bad puns as well. Very. Sometimes extremely. Sometimes puns you can't get out of your head for the next year. You just groan constantly. It's horrible. Second disclosure given. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That's not a coincidence because the two guys in that firm and the two guys on this program are the same two guys. The program predates the firm, but at the firm level, we've got to give fiduciary investment advice. That's what we're signed up to do. What does that mean? It's got to be in the best interest of the client. Can't do that on the radio. We don't know who you are. There's privacy stuff involved. So what are we doing here? If we can't give you advice, why are we on the air? Hopefully, we're going to give you some edumacation and not in athletics. We will be giving you, hopefully, some stuff that you can use in your decision-making process. Just because the firm's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC, a firmly disapproving government authority, is going to somehow give us some kind of a thumbs up. Nope, that's just our regulatory agency. They don't approve, they don't attaboy, kudos, or any other form of pats on the back, shoulder, or head. They are required to come and check people out. Doesn't mean if you haven't been caught that you haven't done something wrong, but that's their job, to go out and find people. Okay, let's see here. This is not a paid-for program. We don't pay for this program. We're not paid to do the program either, which is some kind of weirdness when you're talking to economists. Why are you doing free work? Hopefully what we are providing on the air here is performing some kind of benefit long-term to the listeners. And the very concept of capitalism as written by Adam Smith says that if we can improve ourselves and those around us, then everybody improves. There's a whole invisible hand in there too, but that would almost imply an invisible fly as well. So I wanted to... Yes, that's a very long-winded disclosure. You've got a disclosure to add now.
The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
There. Well done. Now we have disclosed all of our disclosures to say that we are not closed about anything. We're open. Why don't they just call them openings? So they're at the beginning of the program. They're disclosures. It's like we're unclosing the door for you here. Okay, so what happened this week in the market?
It's September, all week. Yes, 1st of September and the beginning of this week occurred on the same day.
Well, that's so a weird September coincidence. Very strange.
And during September...
Did you predict this? Predict
September?
This seems very surprising.
That September showed up?
Yes, it's very unpredictable this time of year. Who would have expected it? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, during September, and markets, stock markets, tend to decline all around the world, and nobody has been able to really give a definitive reason why. There's lots of theories, there's hypotheses. We have ours, somebody else has theirs, but it happens. And fundamentally, there was nothing significant in the news during the week that was particularly negative, but the S&P 500, representing the U.S. stock market, fell 1.29% to 4457.49. It's still above the 4400 range.
I think the only thing that could have contributed to that as a big piece of news is China and their approach to the iPhone, which is a really, really silly reason for the entire stock market to go down. But when Apple starts down and then it holds a big chunk of the S&P 500 because it's big.
It's the biggest.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were several things that came up that clearly affected the market, but they weren't significant. For example, Russia and Saudi Arabia decided not to increase their oil output, to stay on the limited output they have been claiming to be on for the last several months.
They announced no change. That was the the announcement was no announcement. That was their they announced, but nothing is announced. So
and the news came in on Wednesday that the United States economy is growing very nicely and did grow in the third quarter. And that caused worries that the Federal Reserve will raise rates higher, longer than was expected, which caused a little dip in the market. And then it was Thursday, it was worries about Apple. The market actually went up a little bit on Friday, but it boils down to the fact that we're coming in off vacation. People are paying attention to getting their kids back in school. And so a lot of the buyers that trade on the market aren't buying as much as they normally buy. And so September tends to be kind of a meh month. I've been asked several times by people, if you know that September is a month when the market normally goes down, why don't we just get out of the market at the beginning of September and get back in at the end? The same reason we don't do buy in May, sell in May and go away. Some years, the market hits a peak in beginning of May, and it's October before you could safely get back in. But there are other years when it goes up all through that time period. So trying to guess what's going to happen in the immediate future is not profitable, so we don't do that.
Yeah.
The S&P 500, though, is up over 16% this year. It's a 24%+ higher than it was last October. And for those of you who remember that ancient time of March of 2020, when the pandemic was hitting full blast.
That was like 3 centuries ago.
Yeah, well, more like 3.5 years ago, not even 3.5 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, the market has, the S&P 500 is twice as high today. It's doubled since its position in March of 2020.
That was exactly 3.5 years ago.
And it's 35% higher than it was 3 years ago exactly. But it's still down about 7% from where it was at the beginning of 2022. And that's just the way this market is operating. It gets within about 8%, 7 or 8% of the record it set January 2022, and it slides back a little bit. And why does it do that? Because people are scared it will slide back a little bit. Basically, and we've said this many, many times, I'm not completely sure who coined the phrase, although I first heard it from John Templeton, a bull market climbs a wall of worry. And we've got a lot of worry out there, which indicates we're probably in a bull market. And I think we are in a bull market. And I think it will sometime, I would not be at all surprised to find it finally break through its January 2022 record high this year sometime, towards the end of the year.
So Sir John Templeton said that. He said, a lot of people have said that bull markets climb a wall of worry. And then he coined a phrase of his own. He believes that bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. And that, I think, is something encapsulated in behavioral finance. But he was several decades ahead of his time in saying that. The reality is that when we're in a bull market, the headlines that you see out there right now about everybody's all scared about everything, that's what you should expect to see in a bull market. It's weird. We're not back to the top that we were in before. And most people think of a bull market as somehow breaking new ground and making a new record every day. That is when you're maturing on optimism and getting into the euphoria world. What you have in a normal bull market is people recognizing value that's been undervalued, people recognizing companies that have been oversold and buying into them, but they're afraid because they just were oversold. So when you buy something cheap, it doesn't matter if you're buying a car, a new purse, not that I've ever purchased a new purse, maybe a man purse for myself, but the reality is if you just got it cheap, is it going to fall apart? Is there something really wrong with it? Why is the market valuing it so low when I think it's a good quality item? And that's what bull markets are made out of. So there's always this, well, yeah, I think I got it at a good price. I think I did. I think I got in there and I got it. But whoa, everybody else was selling it. And it doesn't matter how professional you are at it. When everyone around you is pessimistic, it's really hard to be optimistic. And vice versa is true. So when we're in the world of euphoria And I would invite you all to go back and listen to our radio programs in 2019. They're on our webpage. You can find them on podcasts as well. So going back then and us talking about, hey, things are getting euphoric, you can actually go back farther than that in our news program, in our radio program, to pre-global financial crisis and listen to us say, hey, things are a little over the top right now. Expect things to get bumpy. Why were we saying that? We weren't reading some great chart of technical data. We were looking at headlines and everybody was saying, this is going to go on forever, and saying, that's not how this works. We live in a world of cycles, and this does not feel like a bull market, which makes it a bull market. was that the end of what happened in the market this week?
No,
I just interrupted you. Sorry, go ahead.
And if you have followed this, as we tend to do, the high interest rate on the, you know, high yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is the benchmark for the rest of the bond or borrowing market, was in the upper threes for a long time, and that was unusually high based on recent history. And then it went above 4%, and now it's up to 4.26%, and it's been rising pretty steadily since it peaked in October, slid a little bit backwards, and then started back up again. In longer-term interest rates, as we have suggested, are going up very slowly. They're very slowly creeping upward. The very, very short-term securities, the bills, they're called, less than 1 year, are all yielding well above 5%. And that's kind of the going interest rate. I just looked at a Treasury money market fund yesterday, and it was the seven-day SEC yield, which is, over the last 7 days, the average yield in this particular security, this particular fund, if it were extended for the whole year, would have equated to 5.29%, which is
kind of seeing that in a lot of places. You can see it in CDs at banks now, although they're not quite that high. They're getting up
there
close.
They're not that high. Yeah, they're up about 4.29%. The highest one I've seen so far is 4.75, but there may be some higher ones out there on CDs. But what the important thing to recognize is that interest rates are significantly higher than they have been, and there is no indication anywhere that they will go down anytime in the foreseeable future.
Now, just throw this out here.
Really good reason for that.
One-year CDs in a couple of places are going at 5.5%.
But that's an online bank or someplace, not local.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's correct.
The banks that don't have bricks and mortars, they don't have physical buildings, obviously can afford to pay a little more than others do.
Bank of America is offering a 0.03% interest 1 year minimum deposit,
$1,000. 0.03 interest?
Yeah, percent. 0.03%.
I wonder if they're getting a lot of takers on that.
Probably not. When at the same time, Sallie Mae is saying 5.15% and U.S. Bank is 4.95%. So this is we'll be going into more detail about this. Some of our first questions of the hour are on this exact subject, though they may not even know it. But back to you in the market.
Well, we just talked about the Treasuries. We've been saying this is going to happen for some time, but short-term rates are high and they're going to remain high for some time. How long exactly, I can't say. About a year from now, I think, would be the median guess as to when they will start to come down on short-term rates at the earliest. And there's a couple of reasons these short-term rates are so high. One is, obviously, the Federal Reserve is cranking up the rates at the very short-term overnight level. That's what they control. But the Federal Reserve also has a huge balance sheet. Balance sheet means they own a lot of bonds and notes and bills, and they want to unload those and convert them to cash. This is part of how they slow the economy down. If you have $1,000, and this is just a generic example, if you have $1,000 and you can spend it on something, you may decide to go spend it on something. But if you see that there is an attractive rate let's make it $10,000 in a $10,000 treasury bill, that's paying, let's just say, 5.5%. You can buy that, and it's very liquid and will mature in less than a year, and it's going to pay you 5.5% annualized to hold it. When you buy that, and let's again make this oversimplified, let's say you bought it straight from the Treasury, which is possible to do, $1,000 disappears out of circulation in the economy.
You took $1,000 out of your bank and you put it to the Treasury.
Right. You're not going to go buy something as a consumer with your $1,000. It in effect disappears for a while, which is part of how the Federal Reserve reduces the money supply. During the pandemic and immediately following, the Federal Reserve was buying bonds on the open market. They bought a lot of bonds on the open market. That tends to keep interest rates down, and it takes money from the Federal Reserve's coffers and puts it in the hand of people who will spend it, hopefully.
And we did.
And now the reverse is happening, and the Fed has got a huge balance sheet they need to shrink so they'll be ready for the next crisis, and they've got to sell those. And the more they sell, the more Treasury securities they sell, the higher interest rates will go. Because when there are more sellers than buyers, the value of anything goes down. But on a bond or a note or a bill, as the value falls, the effective interest rate automatically rises because they're still paying out the same number of dollars. It's just a higher percentage of the underlying security. So when Chairman Powell and other members of the Fed, voting members, have said again and again and again, interest rates are going to remain higher longer than the pundits on Wall Street or anywhere else expect, I take their word for it. It's in fact going to happen.
Yeah. In the last week, the Federal Reserve sold $20 billion of bonds in. In the last month, slightly more than $100 billion. They do it in clumps, and any calendar month, they're supposed to stay right in that $95 billion range. But anytime they're selling, anybody that's selling almost $100 billion a month into a market causes the price to go down. That causes interest rates to remain high. So as long as that goes on, interest rates are going to remain high. Pre-pandemic, the Federal Reserve had right under $3 trillion in its coffers. It wants to get back there. It's got over $8 trillion now. So at roughly $100 billion a month, it's a little less than that. We're still talking 3.5 years before interest rates go back to what people are expecting at this rate, at this heavy rate of selling. So it's going to be up for a while. The Federal Reserve does not want to keep this balance on the books indefinitely. They want to sell it down. And that means interest rates are going to stay up. They recognize that if they sell any faster than they're selling right now, it will have a really bad effect on the economy. They saw that in the first bank failures. And having said, this is kind of the wrap up there. We've got a question from Inquisitor John. And as much as we've been talking about interest rates, this is right smack into his question. What is it? What is your?
I haven't finished the markets.
Oh, please do.
Oil. West Texas Intermediate crude, which is the benchmark in the United States, is at $87.29 a barrel. That's the highest price we have seen since last October. Get ready for higher prices at the pump. Why did it go up? Two reasons. We mentioned earlier that Saudi Arabia and Russia have said they're going to continue with their reduced output of oil, which generally tends to run the price of oil up. And the news that came out this week that the United States economy is accelerating, which means there will be greater demand for oil in the future. And so the price has been creeping upward. And that's the end of the markets.
All right. Inquisitor John, our most faithful questioner, questions us about everything. As is tradition, his email to us is of a digital picture of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal. We have a digital to analog to digital conversion going on here, and it is traditional. His subject was show question, doom loop. Why are the big banks not invested in commercial real estate like medium-sized banks? And what is indirect lending? He's got an article headline from the Wall Street Journal, Real Estate Doom Loop is a Threat. There's a circled area. In that circled area, it talks about regional and community banks dominating the commercial real estate lending market, and how that started after the 2008 financial crisis when the big banks reduced their exposure there. They stopped investing in loans to commercial real estate at the same level. So his question is, why did they do that? You had an answer pre-prepped, I believe, Elder Baldy. What was your, because I can get the indirect lending side if you want to get the
okay.
why is it this? Why is why, it? medium-sized banks are doing this.
There was this event in 2008 and 2009 that most people have forgotten about by now, where the big banks did a lot of lending. It was indirect lending, which Jake is going to talk about mostly, to people who wanted to have real estate companies and who wanted to build houses and who wanted to borrow money to buy the houses. It was very lucrative. It was very profitable business. It was going really, really strong. And then the bottom fell out from under it because it was a bubble. It was a classic bubble. And the banks got their hands slapped by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and the Comptroller of the Currency and said, the big banks said, and they said, don't do that no more. Don't you ever do that again. And so the big banks have shied away from real estate lending. They do some, but not a lot. And they're very conservative about it. However, the regional banks and the smaller banks during this time period that we've been through of very, very, very low interest rates really wanted to be able to earn some interest and have a difference between the price, the interest rate they charged when they loaned money and the interest rate they were paying people who had money deposited. That's where they make their main profit. So they loaned a lot of money on real estate loans because real estate loans tend to be higher interest than personal loans. And they have, as a result, a fairly large real estate portfolio held in medium and smaller banks. And here's the problem with that. Commercial real estate, I mean. Here's the problem with that. If somebody doesn't pay on their mortgage and the bank has to go out and foreclose on the property will likely sell at a very low price. The bank will lose some money, but they'll get some money back. But the process of doing that causes the price of the other real estate they have in the same geographic area to go down because they're comparing sale prices and the sale price of the real estate that they have loaned to somewhere else nearby drops. And at some point, they get into this thing where the more they foreclose, the lower the prices go. And the lower the prices go, the worse their financial situation gets and the more they have to foreclose on. And this dates all the way back to the banking crisis in the early 1990s and other times when we've had these banking crises. It's a terrible thing to see happen. And there's a real sincere, dedicated effort by banks and by the people who supervise banks to try to see what they can do to keep that from happening. And it's going on very specifically. If you actually read the Wall Street Journal or any other similar publication, you will note that there's little stories about such and such a building or such and such a real estate owner decided to simply let the bank foreclose on the building.
Yeah.
So rather than paying the payments.
There are, and you mentioned this, but I'm going to kind of give it some more detail. In commercial real estate, let's back up a little bit. Commercial real estate loans have higher interest rate than a normal personal mortgage. Why is that? Well, the failure to pay on a mortgage is less likely than the failure to pay on a business loan. Well, why? Here's a quick and easy answer. Elon Musk, when he bought Twitter, now X, what did he do with all the contracts? I mean, he had valid contracts with banks and landlords and all kinds of things, and he decided not to pay them, not because he was short on money, but because he wanted to cut costs. So now there's a bunch of lawsuits coming against us. Well, lawsuits are expensive. Foreclosures are expensive. If and I've seen this in my career, you've sure certainly seen it in your career, somebody sells a business and they sell it to somebody who buys it and then the business fails 2 years later. Or someone's in business doing well and they have a midlife crisis and the business fails. Well, what does that mean if you have a real estate loan to that business? Well, it's gonna not get paid. There are lots of folks in small businesses that their personal finances are tied directly to those loans, and those loans tend to get paid. How's that for weird? The loans that are owned by the owners of the business, the loans that are made to the owners of the business for the business tend to get paid. So small business loans have been relatively profitable for a long time for small banks. Small banks have been usually the only ones to give loans to small businesses because a big bank really can't be bothered to send somebody corporate to go investigate a little business, where a little bank has the time to do that. This is the old traditional model. So commercial loans at the small business level have traditionally been regional banks, little ones to medium size. After the global financial crisis, which wasn't a big smash against commercial real estate. It was a big smash against residential real estate. But regulatory authority went up and regulations had to be followed. And the big banks saw that if they got concentrated in commercial loans, the risk there was too high for the regulators to bear. So they lowered their exposure there. They still loan, but they have taken a very back seat to the regional banks that are giving those loans out. Well, now the regional banks are the ones holding this commercial real estate debt. And we've had multiple bad things happen to commercial real estate. Number one, the pandemic. That was not friendly to commercial real estate at all. There were a lot of grants and loans and paycheck programs, paycheck protection program, which was intended to pay mortgages and rent, but it didn't cover the whole time period. There were other loans that came out. And okay, so now we have a whole bunch of folks that were mostly able to pay their mortgage and rent during this time period. But then everybody starts working from home. And when we come back after the pandemic, we still have the majority of big companies have a large number of their employees not working at a physical location that's controlled by the company. Well, if they can do without that real estate, it's an expense they don't have to do. Now they're starting to say, well, maybe we need to get everybody back in. A lot of companies are enforcing that. But we have big vacancies now throughout downtown locations. In the middle of that, during the pandemic, prime real estate markets changed. San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle were the top of the real estate market. They were the places that people talked about affluence and localized inflation, and the only people that walked downtown were wearing Rolexes. Well, that's changed in a very drastic manner in the last 3 years. The real estate values in downtown San Francisco have dropped through the floor. Well, why? Because there's a homeless population there and there's crime there. And well, what's happened? Well, the pandemic and all the things that were attached to it. The rising homeless population, rising crime in the inner cities, all the things that happen throughout history whenever there's a plague. Every plague in history has had this happen. We can point at individual policies and wax eloquent about how, you know, Austin should have done this or Houston should have done that. Or what you're going to find out is it really doesn't matter the big city, the homeless population is up. It doesn't matter what political party is in charge there. The homeless population is up. It's a plague thing. What does that do to real estate values in downtown compared to the golden era when there weren't people sleeping outside the front door? It's not good. So you put this together with rising interest rates, which means the balloon notes on these, a personal mortgage can go for 30 years. Commercial loans tend to go for like 10 years, and then they have to either refinance or pay back all the principal. That's a big responsibility. That means a third of the way through the loan, you got to look around and find another financer or refinance with the current one. And that means that your payment is about to go up if you're a company. It's going to go up a lot because you have an interest rate from 10 years ago, which is like 4% or 5%. And it's about to be 8% or 10%. Yep, those are real numbers that I just quoted. That is not fiction. We got a big, big upgrade in the price at the same time that the actual value has fallen. So what is that going to do to the market? It's pretty obvious. It's not a good thing. So looking around at these middle-sized banks, what's going on there? What are the safety nets for the banks at these failures? Well, number one, there's a big look at the reserve side. That's already been covered. When SVB failed, when the First Republic failed, the Federal Reserve allowed banks to take cash for their long-term treasury notes at the value of maturity. That means they have enough pure cash sitting in the bank that if there's a run on the bank, they can handle it. They also have enough that if they start to have their loans go bad, the underlying value of the collateral. So if there's a piece of property in downtown San Francisco and they've got a loan on it and the loan stops getting paid, well, they foreclose. Now they have a piece of property that they don't want to sell today. If they go to sell today, it's going to really mess them up. What happened in the 1990s, you made a great reference to this. The Resolution Trust Corporation was put together by the George H.W. Bush's team and the hangovers from Ronald Reagan's team. It was a company devised by Congress and the executive branch to buy up bad loans that savings and loans companies had given to commercial real estate ventures. So this was the last big commercial real estate failure, and it was really big. So the Resolution Trust Corporation went out and bought up all the properties that were underwater, essentially, that the banks or the savings and loans were holding, couldn't sell because nobody wanted to buy them. Resolution Trust Corporation came and bought them. And everybody said, this is a horrible, horrible government bailout. Why are the Republicans doing this? They're against bailouts. This is the reason we had a no deficit in 2000 during the Clinton administration, because the Resolution Trust Corporation began selling those properties when the property value went up again and wound up making a tremendous amount of money that it put back into the coffers of the United States government, which at the same time we had capital gains tax down, and it gave us a surplus in the year 2000. We had a surplus that went into the George W. Bush administration too, and it came mostly from the Resolution Trust Corporation. That was the difference, enough to put us over. So is that something that's likely to happen again? Big question. Don't know. We may not have the kind of commercial bank or commercial real estate failure that it looks like we're going to have, but it doesn't look good. It really doesn't look good for commercial real estate right now. The last thing is, what's indirect lending? Let me quick say that.
Go ahead.
In the mortgage world pre-global financial crisis, it was the mortgage broker. They didn't work for the bank. They got a commission. So they're a third party who's not connected to the loan, who's facilitating the loan. The same thing happens when you're at a car dealership and you need a loan on your car, and the dealer calls 14 different places and says, this is what's available. Well, they're actually working through a broker now. It's the car broker, but it's also a loan broker. You're not talking directly to the lender, and that kind of pushes the risk further out. There's another way, you know, commercial real estate loans don't really have mortgage brokers as much as the mortgage market did for the private side before. But they do have large corporations that, in essence, function the same way. They get loans from regional banks to give loans for commercial property, and then they sell on the mortgages to the regional banks. So that is, there's some extra danger there, in that whenever you remove risk from the people that are taking the risk, when you remove the ability to see the risk is there, people get surprised by it for some reason. Yes.
One of the things, our family, my wife recently bought a car, and she was looking, she actually worked through the dealer to get the loan because they were offering a better rate. The dealer is obviously not the bank.
Right.
There is a classic indirect loan. There's another classic indirect loan if you borrow from a credit union. A credit union is not a depository institution. It doesn't hold its own money. It deposits the money at a bank every night. The bank effectively is making the loan through the credit union. And if you have gone to buy cars or anything recently, you know, so credit unions are offering, generally speaking, a lower interest rate on a loan than the banks are, which should be slightly alarming. But the point is, no bank loan officer interviewed you or looked at your application or anything else. And when you have that happening, there is the potential for a problem, and it's happening a lot.
There you
go. And it's time for commercials.
Yes. Well, if you would like to join the conversation, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That is the personal wealth coach, or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. We're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the personal wealth coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And we have lots more to talk about. We have barely even scratched the surface of things we have to talk about. One of the big things we both had to talk about this week was China. Would you like to lead the conversation on that, or would you like me to start with one of my stories?
Well, I can lead if you'd like. China's in a hurt. It's in a hurt a lot of different ways. It avoided the 2008-2009 recession by building what are called ghost cities, and they spent a lot of money doing that, and seemed to have recovered from it nicely, and they cruised along, and they have continued to grow. China has had amazing growth over the last several decades. It is an amazing thing to come from a backwards agrarian society where the ox was still commonly in use and is still in some places in China, to the modern China driving electric self-driving vehicle, or being electric nearly self-driving vehicles that we see today in urban China. It has grown phenomenally. But that growth was based on the fact that the government said, we will remain nominally communist, but we're going to allow you capitalists just to take off and run with it and do whatever you can, as long as you don't threaten us. Well, they've cracked back down now. Xi doesn't believe in that, and he has basically crunched some of the biggest companies and the biggest billionaires in China into non-existence. And during the pandemic, when it finally hit China, they delayed it quite a lot. They were locking down cities and areas, and the people weren't getting food. There were riots, and finally he relented and let people run around, and then a lot of people got COVID. And it was expected generally that China would come back strong like the United States did after the pandemic lockdowns, because they had been the people in the apartments and in the houses and wherever had been under quarantine and not able to go out and buy anything. They would go out and buy a lot. Well, it boomed a little bit and then it fizzled. And there's a couple of major issues going on. And I've read about this in several places. I don't claim to speak Mandarin, but I have certainly read articles by people who live in China and who do speak Mandarin. There was an unwritten contract between the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party and the people in China that they would put up with the very restrictive, draconian lack of freedom of speech and a lot of the other freedoms that people tend to want to have, as long as the government kept making them prosperous. And it did, and it did a good job. And the government focused really, really hard on exports. It focused on exports to the United States and Europe. Well, fast forward to the present. A couple of big things are happening. The real estate sectors in China borrowed money and built a lot of housing. A lot of multifamily housing, apartment buildings, and so on. And in many cases, there literally at this point in China are not enough people in those towns to fill the apartments, because they're moving to the bigger cities and their population is shrinking. The combination of the two has left a lot of empty buildings and companies owing a lot of money to banks that they can't pay. Secondly, the contract was broken during the pandemic. People were literally starving in cities because the government would not allow them to have food delivered. And when the government arranged for delivery of food, in some cases it was rotten. This spread around very quickly. And so people are scared. They're scared of their government. They're scared of the economy suddenly crashing again. They are scared. So they're not spending money. As a result, China is slipping into deflation, and there's a lot of overdue loans out there. The largest real estate developer on the planet, Evergrande, declared bankruptcy, and a lot of people didn't get paid their money back. And Country Garden was overdue by 30 days on paying a lot of dollar-denominated debt. They finally paid at the last minute, and they probably borrowed the money to pay, which is not a good thing. So we see evidence that the economy is in trouble there, a lot of evidence that the economy is in trouble. The unemployment rate for those between 18 and 26 in China was, last report we got, it was 26%. But the way Chairman Xi chose to address that problem was ordered the state employment statistics organizations to stop collecting the data and publishing it.
Yeah.
So there's no longer unemployment among age 20 to 26 because nobody is studying it and reporting it, so it doesn't exist anymore.
Correct.
And that's silly.
This is the good way to fix any problem.
And so what we're seeing in China is deflation, prices coming down, people hoarding their money, all the harbingers of a depression approaching. And it doesn't look at all good in China. And here's the Here's the problem with that. China has been building their military tremendously over the years, and they are integrated in the rest of the world. Although one other element I want to mention here is Western companies have stopped their investment in China, which is, by the way, the source of much of the money that has been causing China to grow mightily, is Western, European, and U.S. companies investing by building factories in China. Apple probably leads the way on that.
Yeah.
And which having their
makes this week
goods,
be an important part of the story.
Yes. Had their goods manufactured in China and then sold them here, or parts that they assembled here were manufactured in China. They built plants to do that. There was a lot of capital infusion from the United States into the Chinese economy that enabled it to grow. Well, with the hostilities that are racking up between us and China, or between China and us, they have decided that we're not going to do that anymore. And the fact that, as Jake has pointed out on many occasions, if you patent something in the United States and you patent it around the world, and then you go to assemble it in China, the Chinese are notorious for stealing the technology, repatenting it in China under a Chinese name, and beginning to manufacture it. And their courts simply won't hear foreigners who want to sue on that. So
you have to be represented.
You
have to be represented by a Chinese company in the court.
And if you've got something that you have invented, like the iPhone, if you were the folks who invented the iPhone and the company being Apple, and you have the Chinese make it and you think you got a good deal with China and they're not going to copy it or anything, and then Huawei comes out with a copy of the iPhone that is selling, when the government says no more iPhones allowed in government facilities, government-owned facilities, or strategically important facilities anywhere in China.
Well, just to let you know, most of the banks are state-owned. State-owned means something different there than it does here. When we say, hey, the Pentagon isn't allowing Huawei phones, it's different because that means IBM is still going to, you could still have a Huawei phone at your IBM office. But in China, if you have an Apple phone and you're in Huawei, well, the government has just shown that they have a great deal of control at Huawei. It's partially state-owned at any of the companies there. I mean, it's just not a good thing. It's bad, 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 every way you look at it.
Here's the danger. The effective emperor of China for life, Chairman Xi, has stated that he wants to take back Taiwan, if necessary, by force, and that he will do it in the not-too-far-distant future. If China faces an economic crisis, there are hundreds of millions of people who would get very angry and not have jobs. And that is something that I'm sure he fears dramatically. He hasn't taken the necessary actions to spur the economy back up, to loosen things up, to get the economic juices running again. He has taken plenty of action to remove anybody from any position of authority that's not totally loyal to him. A wounded and dying China probably would come to the conclusion that they have nothing to lose by invading Taiwan. And that would really wreck the apple cart in the world economy. Because we are, whether we like it or not, the United States is thoroughly invested in China. Yeah. We have a lot of companies in the United States have a great deal of capital tied up in China. If that suddenly were to vanish, it would definitely hurt those companies. It would definitely hurt a lot of things we do in the United States. We still import a lot from China. And although that's going down, we're not building new factories there. Eventually, it will wind itself up. But in the meantime, there's a real threat right there.
Yeah, and there's more going on there. The growth perspective for China is definitely a lot lower than it was even a year ago. The exit of many of the companies causing the growth rate to fall there, unemployment in a kind of a prime working age, it's not a good situation. We've got more to talk about on that subject. There's a lot more to talk about on that subject, but we're almost out of time for this hour. We've got lots more to talk about across China. We've got mortgage rates to talk about. We've got all kinds of good stuff. But in the meantime, if you would like to talk to us off the air, we do give personalized, customized fiduciary advice. That's what we actually do when we're not blathering on the radio about things. We blather on about other things, and then we get paid for it there because we're fee-based fiduciary advisors, and we do investment and portfolio management for our clients. And I know this is weird. We're putting a plug for ourselves in here. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, you can reach our office locally. There's real live people during the week and fake people in a voicemail type system during the weekend. You can reach that line locally.
254 847-1111.
And you can reach that toll-free, should you still have a landline, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, tpwc.com. You will see our famously made for radio faces, our wonderful staff. You can read our newsletter and sign up for it there. It's free. I think it's pretty good. You can listen to our radio programs there or podcasts. Podcasts are also available anywhere podcasts are available. We also can be contacted through the contact form or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com.